grief and rage. She has enough power and money to give me as much trouble as she wants. Based on her demeanor, she will try, and her accusations replay in my thoughts like a discordant chorus that won't stop. Who planted the idea that Lucy had seduced and murdered her daughter? Why would Amanda Gilbert bring up my niece for any reason? Why would the Hollywood producer have heard of her? Unless Lucy and Chanel really did know each other, but that seems strange too. If Chanel was a spy, then why would Lucy know her? What business might they have had in Bermuda? And I remember Lucy saying the person she met there was Janet's friend. Chanel Gilbert may have known Janet first. I'm not sure what that might mean. But I have no doubt someone gave the mother a reason to worry that I might tamper with evidence. I don't have to look very hard to know who. Erin Loria is after Lucy. I can imagine the aggressive, self-important FBI agent with her southern roots and twang calling Amanda Gilbert and feeding her all sorts of propaganda, miscommunications, and outright lies. But why exactly? To ensure we're sued? To frame Lucy and get me fired? To turn all of us on each other and watch us self-destruct? What is Erin Loria's real agenda? I seriously doubt it has anything to do with law enforcement, with her damn job, and all these things float up from my deepest, darkest trench of distrust. I can't be certain who's telling me the truth, including my own husband. My entire family, really. And I adjust the defogger, clearing the glass. I'm grateful that the rain is on its way to stopping and the wind is calmer. Thunder beats a distant retreat. I can scarcely hear it anymore. And to the south, clouds are breaking up, flattening the way they do when their violent drama is spent. I keep up my scan as I glance at my emails, my messages. When my phone rings, I realize how easily I startle right now. I'm hypervigilant and jumpy. I recognize the number calling me, but I'm puzzled. Scarpetta, I answer. I hate to start out by saying you're not going to believe this. Ernie launches in without a hello. Why are you calling from the firearms lab? I reply. I'm about to get to that, but first on the list, he says, the metamaterial you sent in may be from Lucy's camera system, which I'm guessing is Star Trek high tech. I asked her that, and she said it wasn't, I'm quick to answer. Not that I've ever seen anything quite like this associated with the security system, he says. Lucy told me she'd never seen the metamaterial before, but she suspected it might be quartz or calcite. It is, he verifies. Specifically, a laser-quality calcite that is typically used in high-grade optics, like camera lenses, microscopes, telescopes. But again, the hexagonal shape of this is very odd. So we can't know what the metamaterial might be from, unless we locate a possible source for comparison. Exactly right, he replies. Which brings me to your buffalo fiber. I'd sure like to know the source of it, because you can bet it's old and interesting. Did you say buffalo? As in home on the range, and nickels from my grandfather's day. Buffaloes have fibers? The same way sheep do. For the sake of simplicity, I'll call what I found a hair, but technically it's a fiber, and a first-time match in my animal reference library, he says proudly, almost lovingly. Which is why I've been building it all these years. You're always waiting for that one oddball something to show up. Buffalo aren't exactly indigenous to this area. I stare straight ahead at a black SUV backing toward me on the flooded driveway. Not SWAT, I think. It looks like a limo. I think if we consider the context, Kay, this hair goes back a long time, Ernie says. Possibly from a buffalo skin, a rug, a robe that's inside someplace or possibly was in an earlier era. The Cambridge house where your truck was parked when you found the dust bunny, the arrow, it's really old. Yes, more than 300 years. My attention is riveted to the SUV, a Cadillac Escalade with dark-tinted windows and a livery license tag. It's slowly backing toward me, starting and stopping, taillights flaring red as Ernie tells me he's been doing some poking around. He's been excavating, as he puts it, and he reminds me for the 100th time at least that he should have been an archaeologist. What have you dug up? My eyes are on the black SUV getting closer. That the Gilbert House was built by some rich Englishman who owned a shipping company, he says. According to what I've come across, the place started out as a sizable estate in Cambridge's rural days when there was nothing much there but a small college called Harvard. The original property included a smokehouse, a guest house and servants' quarters, a kitchen, and one article said cows were kept in the basement out of the harsh winter weather. They'd take them outside to graze, then return them to built-in stalls. I can only imagine the trace evidence in such a place. I see where he's going with this. Trace evidence, like the broken piece of Venetian glass that could be from a trade bead, he says, which could be related to the shipping company, as could furs. But where might such fragile ephemerae have been preserved this long and out of view? I've yet to see anything on the property that could be a time capsule. The house has been renovated and enlarged over the centuries, and the outbuildings are gone, with not much left but the broken bricks and stones scattered beneath a backyard hedge I noticed through a window. Then the FBI helicopter thunders through my mind, and I remember what Lucy said about ground-penetrating radar. The FBI was searching Lucy's property for anything buried. Maybe the place to be searching is here. I resist the impulse to get out of my SUV to begin looking around. Benton and Marino will show up any minute. It wouldn't be wise to wander the grounds alone. And I stay put with my doors locked as Ernie tells me what he's found out about the early American fur trade. He says unusual fibers beneath a buffalo's undercoat can be spun into a fabric similar to cashmere. And this is one reason the skins were a popular export until the end of the 19th century. Bottom line, he adds, as I watch the Escalade inch closer, faltering, lurching, as if something is wrong with the driver. Everything we're finding seems to be from the same context. Water sloshes around the oversized tires, beading on the glossy black paint. The wipers have been turned off. The back windshield fogged up, and I don't know how the driver can see. I'm about to bolt out of my SUV when the Escalade halts inches from my front bumper. It has me blocked in when it couldn't be more obvious that I'm not merely parked here. I'm on official business with the engine running, the lights on. Not to mention I'm sitting inside. I keep my eyes on the Escalade. I wait for someone to get out of it. No one does. The driver's door doesn't open. And I decide the limo is Amanda Gilbert's. Perhaps it dropped her off, then drove away for some reason. Now it's back. Where exactly did you find this buffalo fiber? I ask Ernie. The arrow fletching, he replies. The dyed blonde hair. Human? As you suspected, I'm sorry to say, because the implication is a pretty bad one. The hair is saturated with glue, so you can imagine what's stuck to it, he replies. I can't say whose hair. Hopefully DNA will tell us soon. Of course, we might be talking the DNA of one of our early ancestors. The tissue and hair could be really old, I suppose. They aren't. The excised scalp is dried but not mummified and has a slight odor of decomposition. My guess is it's been in some place moderately cool and dry but is relatively fresh. How fresh? Days old, possibly weeks, I reply. Again, it depends on where it's been since it was removed from someone's head. Post-mortem? Because I sure as hell hope so. But knowing her, that wouldn't be as much fun. Ernie has examined tool marks and other evidence we believe were left by Carrie Grethen during the commission of her various violent acts that in the past year include at least 6 homicides. He knows what she's capable of. He doesn't doubt her existence. He doesn't find it convenient or politically advantageous to blame Lucy for her crimes. He has no compulsion to engage Carrie in a battle that is ours to lose, and I worry that's exactly what has happened. What she set in motion may be too far gone to remedy. Non fare I patti con il diavolo. Non stuzzicare il can che dorme. At this moment, I can't promise it occurred post-mortem, I tell Ernie. Don't make a contract with the devil. Don't tease a sleeping dog, my father used to say. The victim could still be alive, I explain. A partial scalping isn't necessarily a fatal injury. So she's gotten rid of someone else, or is going to, Ernie replies. This isn't about a need to eliminate people as a matter of convenience or expediency. I feel hatred stir in my deep, dark place. It never is with her, even if she shoots the person from a mile away. It's about power and control. It's about what feeds her insatiable compulsions that inevitably cause profound pain and annihilation to anyone in her path. I sure as hell hope she's not torturing someone she's holding captive somewhere, Ernie then says. Given the opportunity, Carrie is fond of removing flesh. If she's in the mood, she doesn't wait for her victim to die before she goes to work with a sharp blade or, in one case I know of, a well-honed chisel. It all depends on who and what strikes her fancy, and she can be impulsive. Benton says she can be whimsical, a word far kinder than I would apply to the likes of her. But she's right about her ability to turn on a dime, as I've heard it defined. If Carrie has a fatal flaw, it's her emotionality. She can't stop until she's over the cliff. Based on her history, that can take years before she vanishes again, or we mistakenly assume she's dead. When I can look at the tissue microscopically, I tell Ernie, I should be able to say whether there was a vital response. I should be able to say with certainty whether the injury is post-mortem or not. Any idea who she might have targeted? Whoever it is, she's taunting us with it, I reply. And on and off, I've been thinking about the boy. What has happened to Troy Rosato? What did Carrie do with him after she murdered his politician father, shooting him to death from aboard his own yacht while he was waiting on the water's surface to begin his dive? I tell Ernie to make sure the DNA lab is aware of my grim suspicion. It would be like Carrie to partner with a disturbed teenage boy to seduce him into doing her bidding, then to thank him the way she does, which is hideously. What do you know about the glue on the arrow? My anger rolls to a boil. Do you have a chemical analysis of that yet? Anything special? Cyanoacrylate. Good old super glue. What else? So far, it's quite the trace evidence bouillabaisse. Ernie sounds cheerful as he talks about the trash in life that he considers treasure. Bovine hair? And remember I mentioned people used to keep cows in the basement? Also deer hair, which isn't unusual. And I found wool, cotton lint, and other natural fibers, pollen and pieces and parts of cockroaches and crickets, plus potassium nitrate. In other words, saltpeter in addition to sulfur, carbon, and traces of iron, copper, and lead that have sort of permeated everything, he says. And I understand why he's in the firearms lab. Saltpeter, sulfur, and carbon are the basic components of gunpowder, specifically black powder. What's really strange are tiny globules of metal that was molten at some point, Ernie says, It's what I commonly see on skin, especially around burns in electrocutions. Possibly part of gunshot residue? I think of the granule I saw that looked like a black sugar crystal. The molten metal is copper and unrelated to GSR, in my opinion. Like I said, I associate it with electrical burns we see in fatal electrocutions. I'm putting you on speakerphone now, Ernie says. We'll let a real gun nut weigh in. You're sure it's not gunshot residue, both burned and unburned powder that we typically see in shootings? I rephrase my question. In other words, could the residue be from something contemporary? Is there some crazy reason GSR could have been inside my truck? And maybe that's why it's showing up in the lab? I'd say no. I'd say it categorically. It's not Ernie talking now. No one has cleaner forensic vehicles than we do. And if the black powder in question is burned, it would be very fragile. Chances are, we wouldn't be finding it. The deep Midwestern voice belongs to Jim, the chief of the firearms lab. Burned black powder is extremely corrosive, he explains, especially when it's exposed to moisture. For example, condensation that forms when a gun barrel is cooling. There's a chemical reaction that forms sulfuric acid, and if you don't know that and don't clean your black powder pistol right away, the barrel is fouled like you wouldn't believe. I'm talking within hours. What we've got here isn't burned powder. It's definitely not GSR. In contrast, unburned black powder can remain viable indefinitely if it's protected in an abandoned armory or sealed by rust inside an old weapon. And that's what Jim and Ernie believe we're talking about. Unburned powder that could be hundreds of years old. And I think of the stories I've heard about antique firearms loaded with ammunition that people assume is inert until the gun accidentally goes off. How many cannonballs have you seen used as doorstops or hanging from gates, especially during your Virginia days? Jim says. If I had a dollar for every one, I reply. Most people have no idea a cannonball from the American Revolution or the Civil War could still explode, but they're basically decorating their house with a bomb. Could the black powder possibly be modern? I ask the question again because it's critically important. Even remotely possible? How can we be sure someone isn't using it to build an explosive device? BP, as Jim refers to black powder, isn't child's play. Using it to build a bomb would be impractical and dangerous. As is true of everything, it all depends on who you're talking about. Listen, I'm the first to say we should never underestimate any potential disaster. Better safe than sorry. And sure, the person could make BP. When I was a kid, I used to make my own, was a regular Betty Crocker in the garage. It's a damn wonder I lived long enough to vote and buy booze. The person I'm most concerned about may do her own gunsmithing, may reload her own ammo, I say to him and Ernie. If so, there would be traces of gunpowder, lead, iron, and copper in her work area and possibly elsewhere. That's why I'm asking if we're absolutely certain the black powder is of antiquity and not from a location where someone might be building a weapon of mass destruction. I personally think it's an old remnant from the same era the other trace evidence is from. It's Ernie who says this, and I search my memory. Chapter 44. I can't recall seeing black powder in any machine shop Lucy has ever owned or worked in. I don't remember seeing its modern substitute, Pyrodex, either. My niece has always been into extreme technology and has been tinkering and tampering with electronics and machines since she could walk. She isn't the sort to care about firing a flintlock gun or a muzzle loader. She's never been particularly interested in things that are old. She'd rather read a book about physics than history. She doesn't collect antiques. She's not particularly sentimental about the past. Lucy does her own hand loading of ammunition and has for almost as long as she's been shooting her very fine guns. I've always preached safety first and would be very unhappy if Lucy worked with black powder. It's easily ignited. It's highly unpredictable, and I've worked my share of explosive catastrophes when someone decides to make a dirty bomb and arrives at the morgue in heavy-duty plastic bags. I remember my surprise in the early days of my career when I realized that the first question in such case is who are the bombers versus their victims. It wasn't always obvious at first that the eviscerated, handless, headless body I examined turned out to be what was left of a cruel intention that literally blew up in the perpetrator's face. Now and then, evildoers do it to themselves. I won't say it's poetic justice, but I think it. How many granules did you find? I ask Ernie, as I wonder if Carrie knows what we've discovered. Or is the evidence in question something she left deliberately? Because it could be. It very well may be. If so, what is it she's hoping we'll conclude and act on? I don't want to engage with her. I don't want to dance, but I'm doing it even as I tell myself to resist. I shouldn't have started, but I did. And the synchronizing isn't mine. I didn't choreograph it. I wasn't invited. I was recruited and tricked. But it doesn't matter at this point. I fatti contano più delle parole. Another thing my father used to say. 5. Ernie answers my question. 2 in the dust bunny, 3 in the fletchling, the dyed human hair glued to the arrow. By the way, Jim had to head out to a deposition. He said to call if you need anything else. Actions count more than words. I'm demonstrating it even as I'm sitting here. If I didn't want to play along, I should have returned to my office hours ago, but that's not who I am, and Carrie knows it. And I've just emailed you a couple photos, Ernie says. Hold on. I log on to the laptop built into the console. I open the images Ernie has sent, and at a magnification of 100 times, the BP granules look like broken pieces of coal, black and irregular. At 500 times, they look like meteorites big enough to land a spacecraft on, rugged and jagged, no two shapes alike. They're mingled with other debris, what looks like thick cables and cords and crystals and vivid colors. Dirt is only dirt when we don't see it up close. Under magnification, it becomes a ruined world of broken edifices and habitats and the disintegrating remains of past lives that include bacteria and beetles and human beings. Well, it's definitely not like smokeless powder, not like any manufactured propellant I've seen. I save the photographs in a folder. Those granules come in a variety of shapes and sizes that are uniform and don't occur in nature. They don't look anything like what you just showed me. But I have to ask you again, Ernie, old or new, what if someone makes BP? Will it look the same as it did centuries ago? She could be making this stuff, he says, as I watch the Gilberts' front door open. Cooking it herself? Sure she could. Jim says most people into BP these days are do-it-yourselfers, and it's risky as hell, but not all that hard. Just saltpeter, sulfur, and carbon, with a dash or two of water, and voila, you've made a cake. And I always add the caveat of not trying this at home. Amanda Gilbert emerges first on the front porch, and I feel a deep sense of doom rumble through me like an earthquake. When it's dry, you break it up and force it through screens or whatever's handy in the kitchen like a spaghetti strainer. Ernie continues his deadly cooking lesson while my thoughts keep bumping into Carrie Grethen. How cruel and cunning it would be to resort to a low-tech black powder bomb loaded with vicious frag like ball bearings and nails. I'd much rather be shot. So would most people. Carrie, no doubt, would be amused by the thought of such a mutilating way to die. Or maybe her goal is to maim and torment, to terrorize, to rip us apart one inch, one limb, one portion of scalp at a time. I watch Amanda Gilbert, Benton, and Marino talking on the front porch out in the rain, as Ernie tells me about other microscopic fragments that he considers significant. It's possible the black powder was once stored in oak kegs, he's decided. It could go back to the American Revolution or the Civil War. Unless it's homemade? The BP Ernie has found can't be modern. He's quite certain it isn't, but I'm withholding judgment. If I'm mindful of nothing else this day, it's to be very careful of assumptions. I'm thinking about an outbuilding. A cellar? He again wants to know if we've searched everywhere. It's significant that I've yet to find anything consistent with contemporary times. Nothing synthetic, for example, such as polyester or nylon fibers. We check the basement. I look out my side window at Amanda Gilbert arguing with Marino on the front porch. And it's empty and clean. It isn't closed or sealed off. It's accessible by bulkhead doors that open into the yard. It could be a place that in an earlier life was an armory and later was turned into something else, Ernie suggests. Just keep that in mind when you're looking around. Amanda Gilbert, Benton, and Marino are making their way down the front steps in the gentle, steady rain. I tell Ernie I have to go as a chauffeur climbs out of the Escalade, and he's a Mr. Magoo squinting, his big ears sticking out from under his uniform cap. I watch him open the back door for Amanda Gilbert, and I'm not surprised by his erratic driving, his starting and stopping earlier. Marino and Benton climb inside my SUV, and in typical fashion, Marino picks the front seat. He doesn't ask. I pull out after the Escalade, keeping my distance. What just happened? I drive slowly over flooded bricks. She's pissed as hell. Marino pats his pockets the way he does when he needs a cigarette. That's what happened. She'll probably sue all of us. Here's what I can and will tell you, Benton says behind my head as we pass other old mansions where Chanel Gilbert's wealthy, well-connected neighbors live. But before he can continue, I interrupt. Did Amanda give you any reason why she thinks Lucy has something to do with Chanel's murder? Maybe that's why the FBI raided Lucy's property. Marino is turned in his seat so he can look at me as we talk. And as usual, I have to tell him to buckle up. Erin Lori is the snake in the woodpile, in other words. But what I can't figure out is how she could have known anything about it so early. You assholes had your chopper up before we even knew it was a murder. He directs this at Benton. You're right. We didn't know about the murder, but we were aware of the relationship, Benton answers. Whose relationship? I ease the SUV to a stop at Brattle Street. We have airport surveillance from Lucy's trip to Bermuda. We know when she landed at the FBO there and when she returned to Boston. We know that, in fact, Chanel Gilbert was on the private jet with her. Wait one damn minute. I look at him in the rearview mirror and his eyes meet mine. Lucy flew Chanel back from Bermuda? Yes. You're absolutely sure? Chanel Gilbert was on the manifest, Kay, he says. And when agents boarded the plane at Logan, they checked passports as you'd expect. There's no question who was on Lucy's jet. Quite to the contrary. I think there are plenty of questions about who was on it. I concentrate on my driving, careful to avoid deep puddles and big branches that are down. I try not to give in to what I'm feeling. It's bad enough that Lucy might have met Chanel in Bermuda, but if Lucy flew her to Boston, then that likely makes Lucy a suspect in Chanel's homicide. It could explain some of what's happened today, but I don't believe it explains all of it. Are we absolutely certain It was Chanel on the jet, I ask him again, as opposed to someone pretending to be her. Or maybe I should wonder if someone was impersonating Chanel Gilbert. Who the hell got murdered if it wasn't her? We're sure of her identity, Benton says, answering nothing. He may be sure of her identity, but that doesn't mean he's telling us the truth about it. Did she work for you? I ask him point blank. Was she undercover FBI? Not for us, but with us. I'm getting the feeling that after she left the Navy, she didn't merely do photography, I reply wryly and with an edge. But she may very well have suffered from PTSD. I would imagine working for some intelligence service like the CIA is very stressful. When were she and Lucy on the jet? They landed in Logan day before yesterday. Wednesday, Benton says. I assume you checked the catering in addition to the manifest, I reply. Why do you ask? Do you know what catering Lucy requested for her guest? Shrimp stir-fry and brown rice. His eyes are on mine in the mirror. In addition to the usual things you'd expect Lucy to have on board. Nuts, raw vegetables, hummus, tofu. Her standing order. Someone ate Chinese food cold? Not that I haven't done it a million times right out of the carton, Marino says. And I slow down as water blasts the undercarriage of the SUV. But not on a private plane. Lucy doesn't have a big galley, and she refuses to have a flight attendant. Stir-fry seems a weird thing for catering. Chanel's gastric contents are consistent with her eating shrimp, rice, and vegetables, but the timing is off, I reply. Her meal had barely begun to digest. She certainly didn't eat it during the short flight from Bermuda to Boston. But what I'm wondering is if she might have taken it home for later. If she'd been out of the house for months, as her mother claims, then there wouldn't have been anything in the refrigerator, nothing much to eat. Which is what we saw when we went through the kitchen, Marino agrees. Except for the fresh juices. And we can assume those were hers. In fact, I'm suspicious they weren't, I reply. What time did Lucy's plane land at Logan? Shortly after 1 p.m., Benton says. And you're right, Chanel didn't eat on the plane. The pilots remember her carrying some of the catering off of it. They had to dig around and find a bag for her. You've talked to the pilots. I pick up on what he just said, and he pauses as if he has to sort through information he might not want to share. Then he says, yes. I'm curious about why you were inspired to do that, Benton. What were you hoping to discover? Were you asking the pilots about Chanel Gilbert, or were your questions about Lucy and whatever the customs agents might have been looking for when her jet was searched after it landed at Logan? It wasn't customs. It was the DEA. I see. Well, the story gets only more unfortunate and offensive. Let me guess, the DEA showed up because there was a suspicion Lucy had found a way to get medical marijuana to Janet's dying sister? It seems Lucy may have gotten it from Chanel Gilbert. Then how did it end up inside an old wooden box in the closet? Marino asks. Who the hell put it there if Chanel's not been here since last spring? Last spring was about the time Lucy and Janet realized they needed something to help Natalie. What you found may have been in the wooden box since then, Benton says. Beyond that, I don't know. And that's the explanation for how Janet, Lucy, and Chanel knew each other, I ask, because of Natalie and MMJ? It's not, Benton says. It's incidental to it. Medical marijuana has nothing to do with how the three of them were acquainted, but it did turn into something they had in common, again because of Natalie. I begin to wonder if Janet may have introduced Lucy to a spy. I ask myself why Janet would know someone like that. Her mother must get the stuff for her in California or wherever, Marino says. I think Chanel was perfectly capable of getting anything she wanted, Benton says. But to answer you, Kay? He meets my eyes in the mirror. Lucy was transporting product, shall we say, into Virginia. It is believed she was supplying it to Natalie the months before she died. Maybe if the feds spent their time and resources on real crimes, I reply, what a different world it would be. Fortunately, they didn't find weapons or contraband when they searched Lucy's plane, Benton says. What the hell? Marino exclaims. Your FBI assholes are just trying to trap her in anything you can possibly come up with, because that's what it's sounding like. Benton has no answer for that. At least not one he's going to offer. Instead, he brings up what we've suspected all along. I'm not surprised, but it's brutal to hear him confirm it so bluntly. The FBI believes Carrie Grethen is a fabrication, a diabolically ingenious one that Lucy conjured up when she went rogue. Pressure points, triggers, turbulence in a domestic life that was already shaky, and Lucy is unstable. She's always been unstable. And let's face it, she's a sociopath, Kay. Chapter 45. This isn't me talking, Benton adds, as if it will make me feel better. It's everyone else. By everyone else, he means the same people he always does. His people, the feds. I'm aware of Marino next to me in the passenger seat, his portable radio upright on his thigh. He's gotten interested in something and is turning up the volume. This is wrong beyond words, and you know it, Benton. I continue glancing at him in the rearview mirror. I don't disagree. Then I remind him of the H&K machine gun, an early model with a wooden forestock. I remember it was at my house in Richmond once. You had it in a briefcase that I assumed you locked inside the gun safe. You must have let Lucy borrow it at some point. I explain what I vaguely recall. Why would I let a child borrow anything I might keep in a gun safe? Lucy wasn't a child, I reply. But it's nagging at me that the chronology is off. If you're talking about the MP5K, then Lucy would have been about 10. At the most, 12 when it was presented to my unit, Benton says. And I think back to when he showed up with the ominous briefcase, which he said was straight out of James Bond. I happened to have it with me one night when I came to your house. I showed it to you because it was a novelty. Did you ever report it missing from my house after you locked it in the gun safe? I never locked it in your gun safe, and it was never mine, Kay. But it was in your possession at one time. Me, personally. His face is unreadable in the rearview mirror. Yes, only once. Very briefly in 1990, which was when I brought it to your house. He has that look he gets when he knows that what I'm about to say is incorrect. Because ultimately, it was connected to the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, I tell him, and I'm distracted by Marino's radio. A female officer is at the river basin. She sounds keyed up as she requests backup and a detective. And you believe that? Benton's reflection looks amused, as if I said something funny. Carrie had it. Then Aaron Loria did. Ultimately, it ended up in Pakistan, I say to him, as Marina goes through his recent calls, looking for a number. Aaron Loria could be in a lot of hot water, and I think that might be one reason she's framing Lucy. I don't know who you've been getting your information from, Benton says. But the machine gun you're talking about was a prop my unit was given as a thank you when the movie folks were filming Silence of the Lambs at Quantico in 1990. A couple of us got fun Hollywood toys like Tommy guns, handcuffs, wanted posters. When Lucy showed up for her internship many years later, she saw the MP5K prop in my office and asked if she could borrow it, which was fine, since the gun was completely useless, not to mention legal, he adds. And I feel foolish. It was a real MP5K, but the barrel had been plugged, the firing group removed, and even the receiver was cut. Is it possible Carrie got hold of it and rebuilt it, got it back into working order? I ask as Marino talks on his phone. Yeah, I heard, he sang to another officer. What's going on? It would have been hard, but yes, she certainly could have. Benton's eyes are on me as I continue to glance at the mirror. That would be a pretty shrewd setup, wouldn't it? Someone gives a machine gun to the FBI profiling unit, and the head of it lets my 19-year-old niece borrow it. Then Carrie steals it, and years later it's used to commit an international crime that would cause our government unthinkable embarrassment and bad relations if the truth got out. Not to mention wrecking a few careers. In particular, Aaron Loria's. Am I right, Benton? Is it true about Budo? Aaron certainly might think it's true. In my mind, it's uncertain at this time if it's a bluff or an example of record tampering. Either way, you're right. There's a massive perception problem if word gets out. Data fiction. We should talk about this later, he says. The way things are going, there may not be a later. I don't want to sound incensed, but I do. If that damn MP5K is ever connected, even indirectly, to Lucy, it makes no difference that the gun was a movie prop at one time. Maybe it was refurbished. Carrie could have done that blindfolded, I'm guessing, I say, and Benton is quiet. And what a lot of trouble she could cause, whether the records have been tampered with or not. Who's going to prove they've been tampered with, or even admit it, because that alone is a massive public perception problem? You know what they say about revenge. It's much better served cold. So why not wait years, almost a decade or even longer, to decimate everyone you hate? I knew what Carrie did at the time, Benton says. Lucy had to explain why the MP5K wasn't returned to the display case in my unit. She said Carrie had it and wouldn't give it back. And then they broke up, and that was that. There's paperwork about the gun, or prop, disappearing. Of course it could be returned to working order, and Lucy knew that too. Even as a teenager, she was too smart to be hoodwinked. Aaron Loria probably wasn't. She probably isn't. I won't argue with you. If a movie prop became a working firearm again, and it now appears it was used to assassinate someone, I give him a scenario. Aaron might truly believe she's in serious trouble. Especially if Carrie's done things to make her paranoid, Benton agrees, and he knows far more than he's saying. Which might explain her leading a raid on Lucy's property. It might explain one of the most bogus search warrants I've seen in a while. Whose idea was it to transfer Aaron Loria to Boston? After you were shot in Florida, she requested it. I'm sure she did. Probably at the same time she fell into the trap of believing a former movie prop she'd once been in illegal possession of was suddenly matched to frag recovered from an assassination in 2007, I reply. But even if going after Lucy was Aaron's idea, the Bureau has to be cooperating, or nothing would be happening. So in essence, the FBI deliberately moved Aaron Loria here to sic her on Lucy. I don't deny that's true, Benton says, as Marino orders me to floor it. Cambridge Street, over to Charleston Avenue. His voice is loud and urgent. The old gravel quarry. There's no good reason for him to have driven his cruiser to the river basin, especially in this weather. He wasn't responding to a call. He wasn't meeting anyone. Not officially. Officer Park Hyde, Unit 237, never contacted dispatch. He didn't telephone, radio, or inform anyone by any means we know of that he was headed to the navigation locks of the Charles River Dam, where boats pass through to enter the Boston Harbor. The abandoned quarry is a foreboding, isolated place under the best of conditions. And I can only imagine the reaction of the officer who discovered Hyde's marked car concealed between mountains of sand. Unlocked. The battery dead. Hyde not inside the car. But the trunk is malfunctioning. It seems no one can open it. I don't understand why she can't get inside it, Benton says to Marino. She? I inquire. Officer Dern, Marino says. She's on the juvenile crime squad, which is probably one of the reasons she responded. She probably figured she'd be familiar with the little assholes joyriding in the red SUV we're still trying to locate. Yes, a late-model high-end red SUV, which very well may be the one missing from the Gilbert house, I reply. The Range Rover that is supposedly registered to Chanel Gilbert, I add. I assume that Carrie stole her identity. She would assume any identity she wants, if it serves a certain purpose, Benton says. What's happening at the river basin? The call where one of the subjects supposedly had a gun, Marino says. Well, then there was another call reporting shots fired in the old gravel quarry. Supposedly shots were fired, Benton reminds us. We can't say for a fact who's been making these calls to 911. The officer went there and got out of her car to look for any sign that the red SUV and dirtbags had been there. She was walking around when she found Hyde's police car. You probably can't see it unless you're on foot. I'm familiar with the area, and you're not going to drive close to huge mountains of sand and gravel that have been there forever. We always joke that you'll disappear into a sinkhole. I'm pretty sure the car was deliberately dumped there by someone who didn't want us to find it for a while. There's no way in hell Hyde drove it there. I don't understand why Officer Dern can't open the trunk, Benton says, unless it's been sealed shut somehow. She says it's been glued, Marino replies, and I think about the silver fish-shaped box he opened with acetone. So maybe there's another camera inside, right, Doc? His jaw muscles are clenching. Or some other prize in the Cracker Jacks, like a murdered cop? I think we can figure out what we're supposed to assume is inside the trunk, Benton says, as if we shouldn't be so sure. If Hyde's in there, he's likely dead, I tell them. But let's not assume it. And we also have to be concerned that gunpowder, specifically black powder, has turned up. While it might be very old and not a danger to anything or anyone, we can't be certain. Happy 4th of July! Marino picks up his phone to make a call. Carrie wants to turn this day into a damn fireworks display. Fuck that! I listen to him get Officer Dern on the line and order her not to touch the trunk. He barks at her to move back from the car. I can tell she's putting up an argument. Every cop worth his salt has only one concern, and that's Officer Hyde's safety. If he's inside the truck, they need to get him out now. What if he's still alive? You hear any movement? Marino asks Officer Dern as he cracks his window open and lights a cigarette. Is there any sign someone might be inside? Okay, we'll be there in 3 minutes. Then he's off the call and saying to Benton and me, how could he be in the trunk and not be kicking or banging around to get out? She told me she doesn't hear anything. You'd probably better get Harold and Rusty there ASAP in case what we suspect turns out to be true. How about you call them? I reply. And while you're at it, tell them to bring a power drill and grab a borescope camera probe from the firearms lab. I assume the bomb squad has what it needs, but just to be sure. You can't take out the damn trunk with the damn water cannon unless you want to kill whoever might be inside. Marino is frustrated as hell. That's why you drill a hole and take a look, I say to him as I drive fast toward the river. And I don't mean you, literally, Marino. If there's loose black powder anywhere, I wouldn't want to introduce a power drill unless it's a bomb squad doing it. How much time do we got? He retorts. The answer is nothing to waste if there's even the slightest chance Hyde is alive. What we know for a fact is the trunk has been glued shut for a reason, Benton says. Not a good one. If it's not a dead body inside, then we should be worried about some other ugly surprise like a bomb. Why glue the trunk shut then? Marino says. Why not let some poor cop pop the lid and boom, end of story? If you can't open the trunk easily, then more people get involved. The more people, the more collateral damage, Benton replies. Maybe 12 people get taken out instead of one. Or that's what we're supposed to conclude, I decide. Chapter 46. Marino couldn't be more distracted. It's worse as we approach the old warehouses, the storage bins, the defunct belt conveyors and bucket elevators up ahead. A high fence and foothills of gravel and sand rise above rusty railroad tracks and soaring stretches of I-93 and US-1. Beyond are the cable-stayed Zakim Bridge and the Boston skyline, the tops of the towers and buildings dissolving in the fog. The rain isn't hard, but it's constant. The basin will be muddy, and low-lying areas will be underwater. I glance in the rearview mirror at Benton. He meets my eyes, and his are lusterless and grim. If he's in contact with his FBI colleagues, I can't tell. "What's going on with your division?" I ask him, as Marino looks out his side window on a call with the head of his department's bomb squad. 15-20 minutes, Marino says. "Yeah, usually we don't need to touch nothing and can stand there until we turn into skeletons, but not when a cop might be dying inside the damn trunk. Yeah, get here ASAP, but I'm gonna start without you. Yeah, you heard me loud and clear." He ends the call and drops his phone into his lap. "Should I expect to see some of your compatriots here?" I ask Benton, because I hope not. "I haven't told them anything," he says, and Marino whips around long enough to glare at him. "Bullshit!" Marino stares out his window again and says, "One of my guys is missing or dead, and your Boston field office doesn't know?" "It's not up to me to notify them unless you ask," Benton says to the back of Marino's head. "If you're inviting me to help, and thereby inviting my office to assist, that's a different matter." "When do I ever invite? And when the hell do you ever wait for an invitation? The answer is, you guys do whatever the hell you want." "This isn't about you guys. It's about me trying to help," Benton says. "And what I'll tell you in no uncertain terms is this is a game. That doesn't mean it's not a deadly one. You've already been so much damn help today, I don't know how I'll ever thank you," Marino says sarcastically, rudely. "I mean, flying around watching Lucy's place get raided and her belongings hauled off, and all the planning that went into that because you guys had to know where she was and when and what would be the best time to spring a little ambush like that, assuming the DEA didn't get her first." I turn onto an unpaved access road, and emergency lights are a rolling wave of red and blue. "You've probably been hatching plots for days and weeks, and I'm sure you never passed along any intelligence you happen to have access to," Marino keeps his tirade going. "After all, it's only family we're talking about. Why should you tell us a goddamn thing?" Benton is quiet. He knows when not to take verbal swings at Marino, who is keyed up and furious. "Right now, plain and simple, we may have an officer down." He isn't going to stop. "And I sure as hell don't need the frickin' FBI's assistance. In fact, maybe if you assholes had kept your nose out of what's going on, Carrie Greffin wouldn't have just murdered someone else, this time a cop." "Be careful," Benton says, but Marino cuts him off. "Be careful? Be careful? It's a little fucking late for that," Marino yells at him. And I realize what this is about. Marino is terrified. He's afraid we're going to die. He's trying not to panic, and anger is his remedy. It's safer than debilitating fear. "Are you telling me you've been careful, Benton? Let's talk about Erin Loria. If she was a cop, she'd be a fucking bad one. As an FBI agent, I guess she's typical. A lying, manipulative bitch who has an axe to grind and an old score to settle. To put her on Lucy's case is like asking John Wayne Gacy to babysit your kids." "I've made it clear I had nothing to do with Erin coming here," Benton says. "Well, what a strange coincidence that Lucy knew her from their Quantico days." "I doubt it's a coincidence." "Jesus friggin' Christ! You have this way of saying shit like it's normal. You doubt it's a coincidence, and you just sit back and watch it happen like a fucking wooden Indian. I don't just sit back and watch anything unless I have a reason, Benton says, as I park a generous distance from at least half a dozen police cars, marked and unmarked. The three of us get out, and I walk around to the back of the SUV, my boots crunching through gravel and swishing through puddles. The smacking of the rain is slower and softer, and cops in slickers and rain suits are huddled a good 100 feet from Hyde's cruiser. It's rain-spattered and splashed with mud. It looks empty and dead. Whatever we do, we run a terrible risk. I see no option that doesn't include a potential horrific consequence, and Marino has every good reason to react the way he is. Usually, when an explosive device is suspected, the bomb squad will render the vehicle safe by hauling it away inside a containment vessel. They might use a portable X-ray machine to determine if there's an explosive device inside, and if so, they take out the power source, probably with a water cannon. But what Marino said is true. In the process, Hyde probably wouldn't survive, assuming he's inside the trunk and not already dead. Rusty and Harold are here, and I trot to their van as it bumps through mud. They park, and I open the tailgate as they climb out in rain suits. I reach for the boroscope, the power drill in their black plastic carrying cases, and then Marino is grabbing them from me. I'll take care of it. He's ordering me around the same way he was Officer Dern. You realize if she has a remote control or some other means to detonate a bomb, Benton directs this at him as he walks closer to us. But Marino isn't going to listen. Someone's got to do this. If Hyde's unconscious and maybe bleeding to death, then we don't have time to waste. Maybe he's suffocating in there, and I'm sure as hell not waiting for the bomb squad, Marino says over my protests, but I'm not going to stop him. And you need to clear the area, Doc. Absolutely not, I reply. I think right now might be a good time to have a doctor present. I'm not asking you. Get the hell out of here now! I'm not going anywhere, and you need to wait for the bomb squad. If Officer Hyde is inside the trunk, it's unlikely he went in willingly and is still alive. He may have been in there most of the day. Your life is a sure thing right this minute, and his certainly isn't. Let someone in a bomb suit drill a hole in the trunk. If this is a trap, Marino, you're walking right into it. And if I don't, who will? His eyes are wide and glassy, and I can see what passes behind them. The dark shape of finality and fear. Marino knows this might be it for him. He would risk everything for an officer he barely knows because that's what cops do. The brotherhood of the badge, I think, and I understand his motivation, but I can't possibly agree with it. I'm in charge of this scene, and I'm ordering you to leave, Marino says to me, and I continue to ignore him. Rusty, Harold, you need to back up, maybe pull the hell way back out of the way, in case I start drilling and the police cruiser blows. You don't have to ask us twice, Rusty says, and he and Harold hurry back into the van. We'll be a couple blocks from here. It's Harold who shouts this. Just call when you're ready. Unless you hear a big bang. In that case, take to the hills. Marino starts walking alone toward the Cambridge police cruiser, abandoned between huge mounds of sand and gravel. He pauses. He turns around and stares right at me. And when it's apparent I'm not climbing back inside my SUV and driving away, he gets on his radio. I can't hear what he says as he walks toward the cruiser with his back to me. But instantly, a uniformed officer strides in my direction, a young cop I've seen before. He politely, firmly tells Benton and me that we need to leave the scene now, and when that gets no response, he warns us. If we don't drive away immediately, we'll be interfering with a police investigation. As if he really might haul an FBI agent and a chief medical examiner in handcuffs, and I'm not paying any attention as I watch Marino stop walking again. He turns around and looks back at us as the rain smacks and splashes more slowly. But it seems louder. It seems more ominous. "Go!" he bellows. "Get the hell out of here!" If it happens, he doesn't want me to see it. He walks on. Benton and I get back inside the SUV, only this time he's in front, and we watch in unbearable silence. Marino has reached the rear of the police cruiser now. He's up to his ankles in mud, and he sets the carrying cases on the highest, driest ground he can find, and he opens them. I see him pick up the cordless drill and attach a battery pack. He walks around the trunk, squatting, standing, studying every detail as he determines where to make the hole. The first bite of the steel drill bit into metal, and the car is going to explode. "It's not what we think," Benton says, as Marino targets the top of the trunk lid exactly in the middle. "This isn't what we think, Kay. It's what she thinks. This is her fantasy, and we're obliging her by playing it out." "Are you suggesting the car isn't going to blow up? That it's a bluff?" "I don't know the answer, but I do know her. I think it's a bluff, but I couldn't possibly suggest such a thing. We should leave." "Carrie's fantasy? And you know what that is, Benton. Isn't it really dangerous to assume you can think and feel like her? I'm so worried about Marino, I don't know whether to scream or cry. Do you see how treacherous it is if you believe you can divine her fantasies?" I hear the high-pitched whine of the drill turning on. I wait for the sharp, thunderous crack, the billowing black explosion. But there's nothing. I know the formula for defining who and what she is and does, Benton is saying. And she thinks she can do the same with us. But she can't. I roll up my window and shove the gear into reverse. She can't possibly, not accurately. She doesn't have a Rosetta Stone that can help her decipher people like us, no matter what she believes in her wildest delusions. Carrie is missing too many moral pieces. A conscience, for example. "Don't ever undersell her shrewdness, Kay," Benton says. "And don't you undersell her malignancy, her sickness. She isn't us." I back up and nose out, driving away as I wait for the worst to happen. "And she can't possibly think and feel exactly like us." Meaning she's capable of miscalculating. "As are we," I reply. And he doesn't argue, but he doesn't agree with me either. I can't hear the drill bit grinding through metal anymore as I drive away slowly through the flooded river basin, looking in my rearview mirror. I watch Marino until he's a small figure I can scarcely recognize. Then he's gone as we round a bend, and I wonder if I'll ever see him again. Sickness? Benton returns to that. "You know better than to assume she's crazy. I'm referring to her physical health. I may never see Marino alive again. For an instant, I'm too upset to speak. I can barely breathe as I listen for the noise of the world coming to an end. Not the entire world.